Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Yeah. Today's episode is brought to you by a refreshing beer. I'm having a beer. It's Friday night, baby. 11:42 p.m. and I'm having a Cooper's Brewery Original Pale Ale. Classic Australian beer. I think it goes without saying they're not an official sponsor of the show because I don't have official sponsors of the show. But if you'd like an unofficial sponsor of the show, it's me. Go to my website, andrewlewis.com, and read one of the books I wrote. I know you like books. so check me out. That was a good ad. andrewlewis.com. Jazzy Jingle by I Am Norwegian there. For the opening jingle. Thank you very much, I'm Norwegian, for that beautiful piece of musicality. We're talking about part four, chapter 7. Looks like we're getting a token Tolstoy dinner party scene. Hell yeah, I love a good Tolstoy dinner party scene. There's a few good Tolstoy dinner party scenes in War and Peace that I remember. Probably a good 4 or 5 of them. And they're always very entertaining. JMama8779 said, Oblonsky, at it again. But seriously, this dinner party should be great. You have to excuse, I'm going to take quite a few sips of this beer during this episode because it's really nice and cold at the moment. But if I wait until after I've recorded this to finish it, it won't be cold anymore. So I'm probably going to drink the whole thing over the next 15 minutes, which means you're going to have to hear me do a lot of sips. Have a beer with me, why don't you? That'll make it even, Stevens. You're probably on the way to work or something like that, but you know what? Have some beverage with me. Have a cup of coffee or tea or whatever you enjoy. I Am Norwegian had this to say. Oh man, I'm so burpy. Beer makes me so burpy. Levin has returned from abroad. This is a bad podcast. So either we've jumped ahead some months or Levin's chapter happened in the past. Stepan has already found another mistress, poor Dolly. It's clear why people like Stepan, so much. Long after his last stay at the hotel, he remembered the name of a footman and struck up conversation with him like he would an old friend. Speaking of the devil, Levin is already talking about death and the meaninglessness of it all. I started a confession yesterday and Levin's words seemed like they were lifted right off the pages of it. Stepan thinks Levin has come over to his side of enjoyment and leisure, women, good food, parties and dinners, social success. But remember the life stages of Kierkegaard. You can only move in one direction. Once the despair of one life stage sets in, you can't return to a state of simple enjoyment. What are these life stages of Kierkegaard? Oh yeah. That was that big, long comment. Okay, we're not going back there. Tolstoy did manage to distract himself for a good while, though. His existential dread started budding at 35, but then he set his hopes on finding happiness in marriage and family. But after 15 years, the question started popping up again, then more frequently, then constantly. Family didn't help either. He was raising his children to the same terror that he felt, or otherwise idiots. Like the main character in Notes from the Underground, he was stuck. I had to know why I was doing it. As long as I did it, as long as I did not know why, I could do nothing and live, could not live. That's Tolstoy. He even uses that bedrock analogy I stole from Nietzsche and keeps bringing up. I felt that what I had been standing on had collapsed and that I had nothing left under my feet. What I had lived on no longer existed and there was nothing left to live on. Oh dear, poor old Tolstoy. Hard to make a stand on some ever-shifting sand. That's a lyric I wrote when I was a young man. Stuck in my head though, kind of seems fitting. Man, 35 for his existential dread. Lucky duck, that's a good run. I think I was existentially dreading by about the age of 15, probably younger. You get good at it. I'm sure we've all by now had some existential dread at some time, right? You just kind of get good at it. And I didn't even have a mortal threat. I was perfectly healthy. Nor did I have someone close to me with a mortal threat, you know. My parents were perfectly healthy, still are. You know, my grandparents still are. But for some reason, I was just acutely aware at that age of that I was going to die. Timing, says Caution. Chapter 3.30. Levin is visited by his brother in the end of September, and soon after that, Levin goes abroad. Chapter 4.1. Vronsky guides the foreign prince around Petersburg in the middle of winter, then visits Anna and stumbles into Karenin. So about 3 months passed between Levin's departure and today's chapter. Very nice. Thank you, Korsho. Well done. Really helpful comments like that. I would have never put that timeline together if it wasn't for you, so thank you. Excuse me. Oh, beer. How good's beer? You guys are probably thinking, man, Andy sounds drunk tonight, but I've actually had, I've just got one beer, one 375ml beer here, and I've only drunk the neck, so I'm going to say 1/10 of it. So I'm not even down to the thick bit of the bottle yet, just the skinny bit of the neck. So I'm not drunk, I'm just in a funny mood. Swim said the Mama Fishy said fun facts about Tolstoy. Later in life he took up tennis and really enjoyed bicycling, so not everything was angst and existential dread. Below is a great article and video on Kierkegaard that I found enlightening and enjoyable. Kierkegaard quote, marry and you will regret it. Kierkegaard wrote in Either Or. Don't marry, you will also regret it. Marry or don't marry, you will regret it either way. Laugh at the world's foolishness, you will regret it. Weep over it, you'll regret it. To hang yourself, you'll regret it. Don't hang yourself and you'll regret that too. Whether you hang yourself or don't hang yourself, you will regret both. This gentleman is the essence of all philosophy. A little bit grim. A lot bit contrarian. I remember my uncle talking to my cousin, his son, and just saying about how so many lyrics are just like a thing and then the opposite of that thing, you know? And especially song names, but also song lyrics, you know, it was so sunny on this rainy day, I just made that one up, or I hate loving you so much. I also made that one up. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, they just say one thing, then the opposite of it. And it seems very much like that's what old Kierkegaard is doing here. Kierke. Have we mentioned Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and wasn't there another one before? That was Kierkegaard as well. Oh, we mentioned Dostoevsky. All the big guns in today's episode. I Am Norwegian said, haha. He did manage to crawl to Kierkegaard's religious sphere in the end. I love that quote. I was included in the first video I watched about Kierkegaard's philosophy, and the quote went round and round my head constantly for months after that. Hey, that's the video I was talking about there in the article. I don't know what the video is. I'm not going to open it up, though. Søren Kierkegaard. I wonder if anyone on this Hemingway list, any of you out there, have read any Albert Camus. He wrote one of my favorite books called The Stranger or The Outsider, depending on which translation you've got. Really good book. I read that in high school for year 10. Might have been my first existential crisis. I can blame the French for that one. Was he French? No, he wasn't. He was from Algiers, wherever that is. He spoke French, though. All right, shall we read a chapter? I've run out of things to say. Oh, yeah, one thing I was just thinking about then is Tolstoy enjoying bicycling. Would they have just had normal bikes back then, or would it have been like a big dumb, what's it called, penny farthing? Right? Like, how old is a normal bike? No, they must have just had normal bikes by then, right? Normal bicycle. I'm just going to search for that. Bicycle. Normal bicycle. That's a dumb thing to search for. Bicycle. Invention. The early 19th century. Excuse me. Oh, God. There we go. Oh, God. All right, so don't drink beer while you do a podcast because it gives you the hiccups. One of my favorite things to imagine is just the guy that invented the penny farthing and spent so long inventing it. And it's such a dumb invention. You got to sit on top of this giant wheel that you pedal and balance up there with no way to steer except by nearly dying. That was his invention, and it was a runaway success. I just love to imagine him just checking out this new invention that everyone's been telling him about, the bicycle. And he's like, oh, it's just a rip-off of my idea. What the hell? And then just the first time he looked at it and just went, oh, no, that's better. That's way better. That's far less dangerous. I don't know what I was thinking. Just being humbled by the invention of the proper bicycle, which he messed up so poorly in his first attempt. That's one thing I enjoy imagining sometimes. This is chapter 8 of Anna Karenina. Karenin, after returning from church, spent the rest of the morning in the hotel. I also apologize for that really gross hiccup I did before, like hiccup burp sort of hybrid, right into the microphone. It was probably awful to hear. Karenin, after returning from church, spent the rest of the morning in the hotel. That day, he had two matters to see to. The interview, to interview a deputation from a subject race, which was in Moscow at that time, and give them instructions, and to write to the lawyer, as he had promised. The interview, though the deputation had been summoned on his initiative, was an affair that presented many difficulties and even dangers, and Karenin was very glad that it chanced to be in Moscow when he was there. The members of the deputation had not the least comprehension of their role or of their duties. They were naively convinced that their business consisted in explaining their needs and the existing state of affairs, and of asking for help from the government. They could decidedly not understand that some of their statements and demands would play into the hands of the hostile party, and thereby ruin their case. Karenin had a prolonged tussle with them, and wrote out for them a program which they were not to overstep, and having dismissed them, he wrote two letters to Petersburg. One of them contained instructions regarding this deputation in this matter. His chief helper was the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, who was a specialist in deputations. No one else could so well pilot a deputation or give it a good start. When he had finished with the deputation, Karenin wrote to the lawyer without the least hesitation, giving him permission to act at his own discretion, and enclosing three notes from Vronsky to Anna, which he had found in the writing case he had taken possession of. Having left his home with the intention of never returning to his family, and having seen the lawyer and communicated, though only to that one person, this intention, and particularly after converting this matter of life into an affair of ink and paper, Karenin had grown more and more used to the notion, so that carrying it into effect now seemed to him possible. He was just closing his letter to the lawyer when he heard Oblonsky's voice. Oblonsky was disputing with Karenin's servant and insisting that he should be announced. No matter, thought Karenin, it is even better so. I will tell him about my position with regard to his sister at once, and will explain why I cannot dine at this house. "Ask the gentleman in," he said in a loud voice, collecting his papers and placing them inside a blotter. "There, you see, you were lying to me. He is at home," came the voice of Oblonsky in answer to the man who had been trying to stop him, as he entered the room, taking off his overcoat as he came. "I am awfully glad I have found you in, well, I hope," began Oblonsky cheerfully. I can't come," Karenin, who was standing, said coldly, without offering his visitor a seat. Karenin had expected to enter at once upon the cool relation in which he would henceforth stand toward the brother of his wife, against whom he was beginning divorce proceedings, but he had not counted upon the flood of kindliness which overflowed the banks of Oblonsky's soul. Oblonsky opened his clear and shining eyes wide. "Why can't you? What do you mean?" he demanded in French, quite taken aback. "Oh no, you have promised, and you are reckoning on that." "I must tell you that I can't come because the family connection hitherto subsisting between us must now be severed." "What? I mean how? Why?" said Oblonsky, smiling. "Because I am about to take proceedings to divorce your sister, my wife. I was obliged to." But before Karenin could finish what he was about to say, Oblonsky did something quite unexpected. He uttered an exclamation of dismay and sat down in an easy chair. "Dear me, Alexis Alexandrovitch, what are you talking about?" he cried, a look of pain appearing on his face. "It is true. Forgive me, but I can't believe it." Karenin sat down, conscious that his words had not the effect he had anticipated, that he would be obliged to give an explanation, and that whatever that explanation might be, it would not alter his relation to his brother-in-law. "Yes, I am under the painful necessity of applying for a divorce," he continued. "I will tell you just one thing, Alexis Alexandrovitch. I know you to be a first-rate and a just man. I know Anna to be, excuse me, I cannot change my opinion of her, a fine, a splendid woman, and therefore forgive me, but I cannot believe this. There must be some misunderstanding," said Oblonsky. "Ah, if it were only a misunderstanding..." "Wait a moment, I understand," Oblonsky interrupted him. "But of course, only this. One should not be in a hurry. No, one shouldn't be in a hurry." "I was not in a hurry," replied Karenin, coldly. "In a case like this, it was impossible to consult anyone. I have quite made up my mind." "But it is awful," said Oblonsky, sighing deeply. "One thing I would do, Alexis Alexandrovitch, if I were you, I entreat you do it. You have not yet commenced proceedings, as I understand. Well, before doing so, see my wife and talk it over with her. She cares for Anna as for a sister. She is fond of you, and she is a wonderful woman. For heaven's sake, talk it over with her. Do me this favour, I entreat you." Karenin considered, and for a while Oblonsky gazed at him full of sympathy, without breaking the silence. "You will come and see her?" "I hardly know. The reason I did not call on you is that I think our relationship must be altered." "Why, I don't see it. Allow me to believe that beside our family relationship you share at least to some extent the friendly feeling I have always had for you, and sincere respect," added Oblonsky, pressing the other's hand. "Even if your worst suspicions proved correct, I never took upon myself, and never will, to judge either side. And I see no reason why our relations should change. But do, now do, come and see my wife." "Ah, we look at the matter differently," said Karenin, coldly. "However, do let us talk about it. But why won't you come? Supposing you come to dinner today, my wife expects you. Do you come, and above all, do talk it over with her. She is a wonderful woman. For heaven's sake, I implore you on my bended knees." "If you wish it so much, I will come," said Karenin with a sigh, and anxious to change the subject, he inquired about a matter interesting to them both, Oblonsky's new superior, a man who, though still young, had suddenly been given so important a post. Karenin had never liked Count Anichkin. Their opinions had always been at variance, and now he could not repress a feeling of spite, quite comprehensible to anyone in an official position toward a more successful man. "Well, and have you seen him?" said Karenin with a venomous smile. "Oh yes, he came to the council yesterday. He seems to know his business perfectly and is very active." "Yes, but in what direction?" asked Karenin. "Towards getting things done, or towards changing what has been done already? The curse of our state is its red tape administration, of which he is a worthy representative." "I really don't know what his tendencies are, but I do know that he is a first-rate fellow," replied Oblonsky. I have just been to see him, and he really is a first-rate chap. We had lunch, and I showed him how to make that stuff, you know, wine with oranges. It is very refreshing, and it is amazing that he did not know of it. He liked it very much. He certainly is a first-rate chap. Oblonsky looked at his watch. Dear me, it is getting on for 5, and I have still to call on Dologovushin. Well, then, do please come to dinner. You have no idea how grieved I and my wife will be if you don't. Karenin parted from his brother-in-law in a very different manner to that in which he had met him. I had promised, and I will come, he answered, in a dejected tone. Believe me, I appreciate it and hope that you will not repent it, Oblonsky replied, smiling. As he put on his overcoat while walking away, his arm struck the servant's head. He laughed and went out. 5 o'clock and morning dress, if you please, he sang out, returning to the door. Alrighty. There we go, another chapter down. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.